Come one, come all, to the demented, heinous bloodbath of a murder metal circus. Macabre's return album, Carnival of Killers, available now on Nuclear Blast Records. Legendary murder metal band Macabre returns after a 10-year hiatus, just in time for the band's 35th anniversary. Carnival of Killers was just released on November 13th via Nuclear Blast Records and is available now, with songs about Richard Ramirez, Richard Speck, Charles Ng and Leonard Blake, and the Murder Mac. This album is sure to satiate the gore lust of all you true crime fanatics. Get your copy now at nuclearblast.com/macabre-carnival. nuclearblast.com/macabre-carnival. And enjoy the ride.
True crime horror story contains extreme violence and adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I am your host, JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story, Season 3, Episode 6, Cannibals Part 3, Jeffrey. You know the name, the expressionless face, and the iconic glasses. But do you know the graphic details behind his notorious crimes? The following episode contains stories of real-life incidents of murder, rape, cannibalism, necrophilia, and one man's quest for a living sex zombie that could never leave him. Join me as I tell the tale of America's favorite cannibal, aided by the sounds of real-life source audio, Frankensquatch, and legendary murder metal band Macabre. This is the true story of Jeffrey Dahmer.
I can see why he'd wonder about those things, but...
I was dead set on going with this compulsion.
I didn't feel accountable to anybody. I didn't feel any satisfaction. Ever. And so you have... There comes a point where a person has to be accountable for what he's done.
At first it was just curiosity, and then it became compulsive.
Other people or other things. So I alone am the one who's responsible for what's happened.
The best route was to help the police identify all the victims, part of me, and just make a complete confession. For at first it was just curiosity, and then it became compulsive. Curiosity. Curiosity.
I understand.
Curiosity.
I just get angry with other people who think that they have a right to... try to blame my parents for what happened. That's not right at all. No one has the right to do that because they're totally innocent. They had no knowledge of it.
At age 29,
that angers me.
Jeffrey met David Thomas, his ninth victim. He reported that he met him on his way to a bar.
Curiosity.
He propositioned him and then brought him back to his apartment.
Curiosity.
They watched a video. He gave him a drink, strangled him, and then posed him.
Curiosity.
He kept the body for were when they were dead. That's what he said.
Pardon me.
Let's look, however, at what he did. What he did was he had sex with them once they were dead.
Curiosity.
Now,
part
in
of
that regard,
curiosity.
Tough
part
questions
of
just to ask you, and as tough as the answer is going to be.
The curiosity.
Did you go into any detail with Jeffrey Dahmer?
The man who would later be known as the Milwaukee Cannibal was born at Evangelical Deaconess Hospital on May 21st of 1960 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to parents Lionel Herbert Dahmer and Joyce Annette. They were a seemingly normal Midwestern family. Jeffrey's father Lionel was a senior research chemist and supervisor at PPG Industries in Barberton, Ohio, and his mother Joyce was a teleprint machine instructor. Jeffrey's parents said he was a normal and happy child until the age of 4, when he was diagnosed with a double hernia in his scrotum, which required surgery. After the procedure, young Jeffrey's demeanor changed, and he became noticeably more quiet and reserved. This was exacerbated by both the birth of his younger brother David in December of 1966, 5 years his junior, and the family's nomad lifestyle. Lionel's career took him all over the country, and the Dahmers were uprooted time and time again. All the while, he became increasingly quieter and more awkward and sullen as he grew up. In 1968, the Dahmer family moved to Bath, Ohio. In their first year in the new town, according to Jeffrey's father Lionel, the boy was molested by a neighbor, something denied by Dahmer himself in later interviews. Jeffrey was brought up Protestant, but became an atheist later in life. Though he was never physically or sexually abused by his parents, their constant bickering left a definite mark on the boy's psyche. As an adult, he was quoted in an interview as saying, "I decided I wasn't ever going to get married because I never wanted to go through anything like that." As a boy, in lieu of traditional toys, Jeffrey preferred to dissect roadkill that he would find while out and about on his bike and bring it back to his house. He was fascinated with the innards of carrion, but even more than the guts, he had developed an obsession with the bones of the animals. When Dahmer asked his father what would happen if the chicken bones left over from dinner were put into bleach, Lionel took it as an opportunity to share his love of chemistry with his son and bond with him. At the time, he didn't know the dark fantasies dwelling within the youth, and would blame himself for teaching Jeffrey the method of preservation that he would use later on the corpses of his victims. Jeffrey's mother Joyce suffered from bouts of depression, extreme anxiety, and strived to create as much conflict around her as possible. She was a hypochondriac and craved constant attention. At the time of Dahmer's birth, his mother was on over 25 medications. Jeffrey believed his mother's depression was postpartum and that he was the source of the growing tension between his parents. As Jeffrey entered puberty, he realized that he was gay. He had his first brief homosexual experience with a friend when he was a freshman at Revere High School in 1974. This encounter left him confused after his peer didn't harbor the same level of intensity of emotions after the incident and became a little weirded out and distant. It was then Dahmer began to have fantasies of the complete control of another human being for sexual gratification. These mental images soon evolved into a desire to possess a human corpse, as the dead could never leave him. The object of Jeffrey's twisted desire was a jogger who Dahmer would often see running alongside the road near his home, shirtless and sweaty. The running enthusiast turned out to be a local doctor. Upon making the connection that the physician had treated one of his friends, Jeffrey faked an illness in order to get an appointment with the doctor. While giving a naked Dahmer a hernia exam, the doctor became unnerved when the awkward young man became fully erect, so he excused himself. After the incident, Jeffrey rushed home to masturbate with the thought of Dr. Matthews gazing up at his member still fresh in his mind. These thoughts would then develop into fantasies of necrophilia involving the doctor's corpse. Dahmer developed a plan to incapacitate the jogger with a baseball bat, and even lied in wait for him, but couldn't get up the nerve to go through with it. Despite his melancholy and apathetic demeanor, Jeffrey became somewhat of a class clown and used his outbursts as a tool to make friends, which were soon dubbed the Dahmer Fan Club. He would entertain his pals by doing stupid pranks and spazzing out, or doing the Dahmer, as they called it, both at school and at public places like the local mall. One of his high school buddies, John Durf Backdurf, would make doodles of Dahmer that would later be turned into a full-length graphic novel entitled My Friend Dahmer, after Jeffrey's eventual arrest. My Friend Dahmer was eventually made into a feature film in 2017 and garnered generally favorable reviews from the critics, and the film adaptation would be partially shot at Dahmer's actual childhood home. In addition to acting out to mask his pain, Dahmer began to self-medicate with alcohol and marijuana in his early teens. By his sophomore year of high school, he had become a full-blown alcoholic and was even known to be shit-faced during class. He would nurse a foam cup full of scotch throughout the morning, telling classmates it was his medicine. In an effort to fit in with his peers and mask the true nature of his sexuality, which was still taboo in 1970s Ohio, Jeffrey attended the senior prom with a girl named Bridget Geiger. He also attended the Revere High School senior trip to Washington, D.C. While Jeffrey was away, his father Lionel finally reached his breaking point with his mother Joyce's antics and the constant struggle of keeping the household together for the boy's sake, and he moved out of the family home and filed for divorce. As Dahmer turned inward, obsessed with his fantasies, he began to drift away from his friends and spend even more time alone. Unbeknownst to Jeffrey's father Lionel, Jeffrey's mother Joyce left Ohio to go live with relatives in Wisconsin, taking his 12-year-old brother David with her and leaving 18-year-old Jeffrey all alone in the family home. The abandonment by his mother and the loneliness he felt left a lasting impression on Jeffrey, and he became obsessed with not wanting people to leave him. Lionel and Joyce began a custody battle over 12-year-old David, but since Jeffrey was legally an adult at the time, he wasn't involved in the court case, and he might have felt like David was all his parents cared about. That wasn't the case, however, as Lionel eventually moved back into 4480 West Bath Street after Joyce left for Wisconsin, but not before Jeffrey would take advantage of being home all alone. Shortly after graduation, while other young adults were planning for their future, enrolling college, or starting their careers, Jeffrey was drinking alone. On June 17, 1978, a little over a week after high school had gotten out, high school friend, leader of the Dahmer fan club, and author of My Friend Dahmer, John Durf Backdurf, was driving home when he spotted Dahmer drunkenly walking along the side of the road. Of course, though the two had become slightly estranged by this point, he offered his friend a ride home. As they headed towards Jeffrey's house, they spoke of their plans for the future, of which Dahmer had none. As the two were about to part ways, Jeffrey offered Durf to come inside for a beer, which at first he declined, but Dahmer insisted. When the two got inside of the house, Durf instantly felt uncomfortable, like the walls were closing in, and made up an excuse to get the hell out of there. Dahmer followed him outside with the bat he intended to use on his jogger, but again, he didn't fall through with his fantasy. That would all change the next morning. On June 18, 1978, Jeffrey was driving around aimlessly in his Volkswagen Bug when he came across a hitchhiker named Stephen Mark Hicks near the firehouse. Intending on fulfilling one of his sexual fantasies, Dahmer picked him up. The two returned to Jeffrey's house and smoked some weed, drank some beers, and talked. Soon, Dahmer realized that Steve wasn't really up for what he was looking for, and the hitchhiker wanted to leave, but Dahmer didn't want him to. He pleaded and urged Stephen to stay and hang out, but when Stephen refused and turned to go, Dahmer struck him in the head with a 10-pound dumbbell weight. After the blow sent Hicks crashing down, Jeffrey finished the job, using the bar to strangle his would-be friend. When Stephen was dead, Jeffrey masturbated above his body. He then took the body of Stephen Hicks to the woods, where he left it to decompose for 2 weeks, frequently returning to gaze upon his handiwork and relieve his sexual tension. Eventually, Dahmer pulverized all the bones of Hicks's corpse with a sledgehammer, dismembered the body, and scattered his remains in the woods. Dahmer briefly enrolled at the Ohio State University and took up residence in the Morrill Tower, a 23-floor dorm room. There, his alcoholism spiraled out of control. He would sell his hemoglobin to the local blood bank for drinking money beyond the stipend his father provided. Jeffrey wasn't long for the college life, and dropped out after completing less than a semester. On Christmas Eve of 1978, Jeffrey's father Lionel remarried, finding a new bride in Sherry Jordan, the operator of an executive placement business. At the urging of his father, Dahmer joined the Army in 1979. For his basic training, he spent 4 months at Fort McClellan, Alabama, and then went to Fort Sam Houston in Texas to receive medical training. Jeffrey was then stationed in Baumholder, Germany as a combat medic in the 2nd Battalion of the 68th Armored Regiment. It was there that his military performance continued to decline. He was cited for coming on duty drunk multiple times, as his alcoholism had continued to get worse after the first murder. They tried to help him with his problem, putting him into rehab in February of 1981, but he was ultimately deemed to be irreparable and a lost cause, and given a dishonorable discharge in March of 1981. In addition to his drinking, reports that military police had also caught Dahmer masturbating several times in a public park added fuel to the fire and swayed the decision of the Army in his release, though he was never prosecuted for the perverse incidents. When Dahmer made worldwide news later in life, when he was eventually caught for the murders, two of his former fellow soldiers came forward with allegations that while in Germany, they had been raped by America's favorite cannibal. One said he had been drugged and sodomized in a single incident inside an armored personal carrier, while the other claimed that Dahmer had sexually assaulted and physically abused him multiple times over a 17-month period. Dahmer denied these claims in an interview after his arrest. After his discharge, Jeffrey moved to Miami, Florida to get away from the winters he knew as a boy. There he worked at a sandwich shop called Sunshine Subs. During his stay in Florida, a young boy by the name of Adam Walsh was abducted from a Sears department store on July 27, 1981. The boy's severed head was later found in a drainage canal near Highway 60. Adam's father John's passionate interviews garnished national spotlight for the case, and John Walsh later went on to be the host of the popular TV series America's Most Wanted, and is still active in the true crime spotlight today. Though some conspiracy theorists use the timeline and Dahmer's fondness of decapitation to place the blame on the shoulders of the Milwaukee cannibal, I don't believe it to be true. Jeffrey's confessions were so detailed, and he told investigators in reference to another murder he was questioned about later on in the story, "Why wouldn't I tell you everything when I've told you so much?" Still, it took some poking and prodding, no pun intended, for him to reveal the explicit details of his necrophilia and cannibalism. So I can't completely 100% rule out the possibility of Dahmer being involved in the Walsh murder, but it is extremely far-fetched. Dahmer stayed in Miami for only a year before he returned back to his familiar stomping grounds of Bath, Ohio, for an even shorter stay of 4 months. In June of 1982, he moved to his grandmother Catherine Jemima Hughes' residence at 2357 South 57th Street in the West Allis suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. At first, Grandma Catherine enjoyed having Jeffrey's company and his help around the house, but soon realized that he was getting hammered drunk nearly 24/7. While staying with his grandmother, Dahmer got a job at a local blood bank, Milwaukee Blood and Plasma Incorporated. He got the idea from his frequent trips during college to a similar establishment in Ohio that he used to fund his drinking habit. During one of his shifts at the blood bank, Jeffrey smuggled out a vial of fresh crimson. He downed the blood greedily, eager to fulfill one of his dark fantasies he had had since he was a child, but it made him gag, and he never did it again. Jeffrey didn't stay at Milwaukee Blood and Plasma long, and soon moved on to work at the Ambrosia Chocolate Factory, and he began attending church with his grandmother and father. On August 8, 1982, Jeffrey was arrested after dropping his pants in front of a crowd of people at the Wisconsin State Fair, where he was heavily intoxicated. He was charged with disorderly conduct and fined $50, a slap on the wrist by today's standards. 4 years later, in 1986, he was arrested once again. This time Jeffrey had been caught masturbating in front of two young boys at the Kinnickinnick River and given a year of probation. Had these crimes been taken more seriously as they should have been, maybe with the proper treatment, Dahmer might not have evolved into the monster he would later become, though I personally believe there's no rehabilitation for pedophiles. While on probation for his crime, Jeffrey began to frequent the Club Bath in Milwaukee, a spa where gay men would meet for consensual and often anonymous sex. He was eventually banned from the facility after multiple complaints from patrons that they had been drugged and raped by Dahmer. After he had been kicked out of the bathhouse, Dahmer had to change up his hunting grounds and move from the seclusion and anonymity of the steamy rooms to the more open, loud, and flamboyant gay bars of Milwaukee and Chicago. It was at one of these establishments where he would meet his second victim. 24-year-old Stephen Walter Tuomi was enjoying himself, relaxing at Club 219, a local gay bar, on September 15th of 1987. It had been a long night at the restaurant, and he was happy to be finally clocked out and having a beer, potentially hoping to get lucky, when he was approached by Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey brought Tuomi back to his room at the Ambassador Hotel at 2308 West Wisconsin Avenue, and according to Dahmer, the two had sex and drank until they passed out. When Jeffrey eventually awoke, he found Tuomi had been beaten to death and had no memory of doing it, though he was sure he was the perpetrator. He stuffed Tuomi's body into a suitcase and dragged the cumbersome burden outside to an awaiting taxi, using the helpful driver to load the corpse luggage into the trunk. He then returned with his prize back to his grandmother's house. The next day, when his grandmother was at church, back in the safety of the shared residence, he dragged the suitcase down the basement stairs and removed the body. Jeffrey became turgid at the sight of the dead man and masturbated over his corpse, and eventually committed his first act of necrophiliac sodomy. He then used a knife to dismember Stephen and watched the blood flow from the man into the floor drain in the center of the room. Dahmer placed the body parts into trash bags and dropped them off in a random alley dumpster. The remains of Stephen Tuomi were never recovered. Dahmer would claim two more victims while living with his grandmother in West Allis. Jeffrey picked up 14-year-old Jamie Dockstader outside of Club 219. He invited the curious boy back to his house with the offer of money for Dahmer taking some pictures and the promise of alcohol. When they arrive back at the house on 57th Street, Jeffrey slipped some sleeping pills into Jamie's drink. When the boy passed out, Dahmer strangled him in his sleep and had sex with the corpse. He then followed the familiar pattern of dismembering the body with a knife, stripping the remaining flesh from the bone with acid, and then breaking the bones with a sledgehammer and disposing of the remains in the trash. Starting with his third victim, he would boil the severed heads in a cleaning solution and keep the skulls in his closet. He would even paint and decorate some of the bleached skulls with granite-colored enamel spray paint he purchased from a local art store called the Palette Shop. He kept the skulls of his victims that he thought were the best looking because he didn't want them to ever leave him. Jeffrey would use the skulls as garnishment to his shrine to the dead, a temple of bones. He later drew a diagram for police of a throne he intended to make using the bones of his victims. In March of 1988, Dahmer's probation came to an end. To celebrate, he went out to Club 209 in search of some action. Richard Guerrero was 25 years old when he accompanied Jeffrey back to his grandmother's house with the promise of a blowjob. Dahmer then drugged him and strangled him to death. He took his time with the corpse, lying next to it and cuddling before ultimately sodomizing the body of Guerrero. Once the deed was done, Dahmer cleaned up the evidence by dismembering the body and throwing the pieces of the dead man in the garbage. Jeffrey's crimes would catch up to him again in the fall of 1988. On September 26, he approached a 13-year-old Laotian boy and offered him $50 to come to his apartment and pose for pictures. There, he convinced him to take off his clothes and touched his penis. Dahmer tried to use his familiar tactic of halcyon-laced liquor, but for some reason, the boy didn't fall asleep and left the residence. When he returned home, his family took him to the hospital and he reported what had happened to the police. According to Dahmer, Somsak's synthesomphone appeared much older, but the boy later told Milwaukee detective Scott Schaefer that he had told Jeffrey that he was a high school freshman. Somsak had also witnessed Dahmer putting some sort of powder into his coffee and had felt very sleepy during the incident. Dahmer was arrested at his work and charged with exploitation of a child and second-degree assault. He pleaded not guilty and was freed on bail with a trial set for May of 1989. But before his trial, in March of 1989, Dahmer was once again stalking the gay bars in search of his next victim. He met 24-year-old Anthony Sears at La Cage au Foyer and offered him money for nude photographs. Anthony was an aspiring model and delighted at the offer. Jeffrey took Sears back to the familiarity of his grandmother's basement. The two had sex, and then Dahmer gave Sears a cocktail dosed with sleeping pills. When Anthony passed out, Dahmer strangled him to death. He then had sex with Anthony's corpse before chopping off its penis and decapitating the body. He used acid to remove all the skin from his prize and place it into his father's old chemistry box. During one of his father's visits to pick up Grandma and Jeffrey for church, Dahmer's grandmother expressed concern after she had found a mannequin in Jeffrey's closet. When Lionel Dahmer confronted his son about the incident and opened the closet, he discovered a metal box which had previously contained his old chemistry set. The box had been fitted with a lock, though, which unnerved Lionel. Even more upsetting was Jeffrey's refusal to open the box in order for his father to reminisce, and the son was obviously hiding something. Jeffrey was able to convince his father that the box contained pornography, and he didn't want to upset Grandma, though in reality, it contained the severed head and penis of Anthony Sears, macabre trophies that Dahmer kept to remind him of one of his favorite victims to that point. It was a close call, like many Dahmer would experience before his luck eventually ran out. Jeffrey moved out of his grandmother's house in the summer of 1988, after Catherine had enough of Dahmer's late-night drunken escapades and the horrible smell coming from the basement. He was finally able to afford his own place at the Oxford Apartments at 924 North 25th Street, Apartment 213, an apartment that would become infamous. Once he was all alone with his thoughts and had complete privacy, the frequency of the murders increased. In May of 1989, Jeffrey Dahmer's trial for child molestation began. Rather than fighting the charges, he changed his plea to guilty and expressed deep remorse for his crime. Jeffrey took the stand in his own defense, claiming that the boy had looked much older and that he was a changed man who would continue to seek treatment for the sickness that plagued him. His desperate act fooled the judge, and he was given a 1-year sentence with conditional day release, allowing him to continue working and return to jail at night, and 5 years probation. He only served 10 months of his sentence before being released into society yet again. After his release in May of 1990, Dahmer would kill once more. This time, he would offer money to 33-year-old Raymond Lamont Smith, who went by the alias Ricky Lee Beeks, in exchange for posing for nude pictures and again drugging and strangling the man. Before dismembering Raymond, Jeffrey would try to revive him via oral sex. It didn't work. The skull of Raymond Smith was kept as yet another trophy of his crimes, painted and stored away in his closet. The remainder of Smith's bones were deposited into a tank of acid until they were defleshed. Jeffrey then placed the bones around his apartment as macabre decorations. Just 1 month later, 28-year-old Edward W. Smith would meet a similar fate after making Jeffrey's acquaintance at the Phoenix Bar. Smith was offered money for sex and pictures, drugged, and then strangled. Dahmer took pictures of the dismemberment process and placed the remains in acid to dissolve. 22-year-old Ernest Miller would meet Dahmer on September 2, 1990, outside of a bookstore. Dahmer took Miller back to his apartment on 25th Street with the promise of $50 to take nude pictures and have sex. Once back to the Oxford Apartments, he spiked his coffee with something other than rum, more prescription sleeping pills. After Miller fell asleep, Dahmer stabbed him in the neck with a 6-inch hunting knife. He then sawed away at Miller's biceps, removing them as he thought them to be the most beautiful part of the man. The remainder of the corpse was dissolved in hydrochloric acid before being flushed down the toilet in a similar fashion to Jeffrey's kindred spirit from across the pond, another notable serial killer, Dennis Nilsen. Dahmer put the biceps in the freezer for later use, bleached the skeleton, and painted the skull and kept those mementos in his closet. Dahmer described the process of the dismemberment of Ernest Miller as follows. I separated the joints, the arm joints, the leg joints, and had to do two boilings. I think I used four boxes of Soilex for each one, put in the upper portion of the body, and boiled that for about 2 hours, and then the lower portion for another 2 hours. The Soilex removes all the flesh, turns it into a jelly-like substance, and it just rinses off. Then I laid the clean bones in a light bleach solution, left them there for a day, and spread them out on either newspaper or cloth, and let them dry for about a week in the bedroom. Jeffrey would often masturbate with the aid of severed and preserved body parts, including genitalia. Soon even necrophilia wouldn't be enough to satiate his grisly impulses. Dahmer would cross the line into necrophagia, or the cannibalism of the dead for sexual purposes, defrosting the severed biceps of Ernest Miller and consuming his flesh. He would also consume various organs from his victims, including the heart and even brain matter. Dahmer said he ate his victims in order for them to become a part of him, and the act of cannibalism made it so that they could never truly leave him in his twisted mind.
I was branching out. That's when the cannibalism started, eating of the heart and the arm muscle. It was a way of making me feel that they were a part of me. At first, it was just curiosity, and then it became compulsive.
On September 24th, 1990, Dahmer met another black male in his mid-20s, David C. Thomas, at Sieste La Vie, and took him back to his apartment, where he also gave him lace coffee and repeated the process. Deep within the short span of the bulk of his murders, on the day before Thanksgiving of 1990, Jeffrey visited his father, grandmother, and other family, and Lyle's camcorder documented the visit.
So what have you been doing lately? Working and working and working and working?
Working next week, starting Monday. I go back to work Sunday nights.
Oh, boy. So you go back to work this Sunday night?
Right.
Yeah. You're looking good, though. You look nice and trim.
Oh, that's good to hear.
You look like you're working out.
No, I've been surviving on McDonald's food since I moved down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're looking good. Grandma was saying that she thought that you got quite a bit thinner, but you look fit. I don't know.
Well, I've been surviving mostly on McDonald's food. It's just so much easier just to pop into a restaurant. But
yeah.
Like I said before, it gets too expensive and
it does.
I have to start eating at home more.
Little did the family know that when Jeffrey referred to eating more at home, his choice of meal would be human flesh. The spring would bring with it two more victims of the Milwaukee cannibal. On March 7th, 18-year-old Curtis Strotter, and on April 7th, 19-year-old Errol Lindsay. Both boys were offered money to accompany the awkward Jeffrey back to his apartment before being drugged, killed, fucked, and dismembered. Two more skulls to rest on his closet shelf. Dahmer's next victim was probably the one he was closest to, 31-year-old Tony Hughes. Dahmer offered Hughes $50 to come back to his place to pose for nude pictures, but the incident turned into 3 or 4 days of sex, and supposedly, a relationship. At the end of their time together, Tony seemed genuinely sad to have to leave Jeffrey, but said he would see him in a couple of days. Jeffrey's fear of abandonment outweighed his infatuation, and he drugged and murdered the man on the last day of their affair. Instantly, Dahmer was filled with regret of what could have been. He waited several days to dismember Hughes' body, instead, lying next to him and apologizing for what he had done. Eventually, the body was dissolved in acid, but the skull kept intact after bleaching, like his previous victims. On May 27th, 1991, 14-year-old Laotian immigrant Conorak Synthesomphone was window shopping at a local mall when he was approached by a friendly stranger, Jeffrey Dahmer. Dahmer persuaded the boy to come back to his place to take some photographs in exchange for a pair of shoes the boy had his eye on in the storefront window. After snapping a few photographs that were perhaps a little more innocent than his ultimate intentions, Dahmer made the pair a drink, slipping some sleeping medication into the boy's cup. Once Conorak was completely incapacitated, Jeffrey brought out a drill. In order to create a lover that would never leave him, but would also remain warm to the touch and not decompose like the corpses he previously kept, he would now attempt to create a living sex zombie. Jeffrey placed the drill bit to the boy's skull and pulled the trigger, applying enough pressure to bore a hole in Synthesomphone's skull and create a pathway to its brain. Dahmer then backed out the drill, placing the bloody tool next to him on the bed and exchanging it for a bottle of hydrochloric acid. He slowly poured the chemical into the hole in the boy's skull like a mad scientist, patiently awaiting the results of his experiment. Suddenly, the boy's eyes widened before closing again, and Jeffrey thought perhaps it was a success. Conorak lived, but now appeared to be in some sort of coma. Dahmer kissed his prize on the forehead before heading off to the bar for a celebratory drink. While on his way home, Jeffrey saw his victim stumbling down the street naked. Two 18-year-old girls, Sandra Smith and her cousin, Nicole Childress, also saw Conorak's zombie-like stupor and sensed that the boy was in trouble. They argued with Jeffrey, who was attempting to carry the boy back to his apartment, and that's when the cops arrived. Police approached and couldn't understand the drugged boy who barely spoke English. Jeffrey had the balls to approach him and explain that it was his 19-year-old lover, though Conorak looked young for his age of 14, and the cops actually allowed Dahmer to take him back to his place, accompanying the pair back to apartment 213. Jeffrey spoke to the officers calmly and eloquently, explaining that the two had a lover's quarrel and presented them with Polaroids of Conorak in black briefs to show their connection. What they didn't know was just beyond the bedroom door was the rotting corpse of Anthony Hughes. Weirded out by the incident, the police left Synthesomphone with Dahmer, and shortly after they left the Oxford apartments, Conorak was dead, strangled by the hands of his false lover, and soon to be dismembered.
Away from his home, that Jeffrey offered a fight. If he take off his clothes and pose, he can give an annual sex with Conrad Synthesophone. And then he went out for some beer and lots of his sleep in his
In a sick twist of fate, Conorak was the brother of Somsak Synthesomphone, one of the boys Jeffrey had previously been arrested for molesting, though he didn't know it at the time he picked up the boy from the mall. Dahmer would repeat this lobotomy process on the rest of his victims, drilling into their skulls and pouring various chemicals into their brains in an effort to create a sex zombie.
Then I tried to keep the person alive by inducing a zombie-like state. By injecting dilute acid solution into their brain, or hot water, and it never did completely work.
After a gay pride rally in Chicago on June 30th, Jeffrey met 20-year-old Matt Turner at the bus station. He convinced Turner to accompany him on the Greyhound bus back to Milwaukee from Chicago, where he completed his typical modus operandi before putting Turner's severed head into his refrigerator. The pace of the killings quickened even further, and Jeffrey would strike only 1 week later. He met 23-year-old Jeremy Weinberger in Chicago at Carol's, a gay bar on Wells Street. They took the Greyhound back to Jeffrey's place, where they stayed together for 2 days of sex. They seemed to be getting along fine, but on the second day, when Jeremy said it was time for him to go, Jeffrey didn't want him to leave and drugged him. Dahmer drilled into his head and injected his brain with boiling water, leaving him alive but in a comatose state for 2 days before eventually strangling him to death. By this point, Jeffrey's alcoholism had gotten as far out of control as his murderous rampage, and he was fired from his job at Ambrosia Chocolate Factory on July 15th. That same day, most likely to cheer himself up, he picked up 23-year-old Oliver Lacey and took him back to his apartment on the pretense of exchanging body rubs. After he was drugged and strangled, the body of Lacey was sodomized and dismembered. Jeffrey stored his heart in the freezer to eat later and put his decapitated head into the refrigerator alongside that of Matt Turner. The very next day, Dahmer struck again. He met 25-year-old Joseph Bradehoft at a bus stop near Marquette University and brought him back to apartment 213, again with the promise of money for nude photographs and sex. Bradehoft was then drugged, strangled to death with a leather strap, and dismembered with his body left to dissolve in the acid vat. He would be the last. One time during his murder spree, a police officer came to Jeffrey's door to question him about the homicide of a neighbor, Dean Vaughn. Through beads of sweat and nervousness, Jeffrey explained he didn't have anything to do with it, which was in fact true, although he had killed so many others. On July 22, 1991, Dahmer would attempt to carry out his plan for the final time. 32-year-old Tracy Edwards came up to apartment 213 for some beers when he was drugged, but he didn't fully lose consciousness. Jeffrey asked him to put on some handcuffs so they could take some bondage pictures, but when Edwards refused, Jeffrey threatened him with a knife. With one cuff on his wrist, Tracy asked to use the bathroom, but then bolted from the apartment out of the front door and flagged down a passing police car. Officers then ascended the stairs to apartment 213 to question a drunken Jeffrey and found photographs of mutilated and dismembered human remains. When they searched his property, they found severed heads in the fridge, as well as human organs and genitalia. An entire torso was chilling in the freezer with its flesh stuck to the ice in the bottom. Throughout the apartment, they also found two fully intact skeletons, a pair of severed hands, two severed and preserved penises in jars, and a 57-gallon drum containing three more torsos that had been slowly dissolving in acid.
He had killed more than a dozen people and eaten some of them in his Milwaukee apartment that was literally a house of horrors.
There are 11 individuals or parts thereof that were recovered. We have also, in addition, through our investigation, determined that the suspect may well have been involved in at least 17 homicides.
Tracy Edwards escaped from Dahmer's apartment and testified at Dahmer's trial.
Mind as to who you were sitting next to who was doing all these things.
A bizarre individual, someone that was very confused at this time.
Jeffrey was arrested and taken in for questioning. During his confession with Detective Patrick Kennedy on July 23, 1991, from 1:30 a.m. to 7:15 a.m., he spared no detail other than the necrophilia and the cannibalism, which he would admit to later. He didn't talk of these occurrences at first, out of shame. Detectives were shocked by the amount of murders that took place over the course of just 3 years, other than that of hitchhiker Stephen Hicks. Jeffrey was diagnosed with depression, borderline personality disorder, antisocial traits, schizotypal personality disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and psychosis, all of which were made worse by his alcoholism. The shame he felt for being gay, his mental illness, and his desire for the control of a lover by any means necessary blended into a perfect cocktail of murder. He used alcohol as a lubricant to commit his crimes, as he would get blackout drunk to reduce his inhibitions and could have never carried out the acts without the aid of liquor-fueled courage. Dahmer said he truly wanted to stop, but couldn't overcome the urges, and once he had crossed the line into murder, necrophilia, and cannibalism, there was no going back. On February 15, 1992, Jeffrey Dahmer was given 15 life sentences in prison, totaling 957 years. He was also given a life sentence in Ohio for the murder of Stephen Hicks. The sentence was not enough to appease the families of his victims, however, who wanted Dahmer dead.
The oldest sister of Errol Lindsay, whatever your name is, Satan, I'm mad. This is how you act when you are out of control. I don't want to ever see my mother have to go through this again. Never, Jeffrey. Jeffrey, I hate you, motherfucker. I hate you. This is out of control.
Your Honor, it's over now, Dahmer said during a closing statement at his murder trial. This has never been a case of trying to get free. I didn't ever want my freedom. Frankly, I wanted death for myself. This was a case to tell the world that I did what I did, not for reasons of hate. I hated no one. I know I was sick or evil, or both. Now, I believe I was sick. The doctors have told me about my sickness, and now I have some peace. Lionel Dahmer gave numerous television interviews and wrote a book about his son's crimes and what it was like to be the father of a monster. Jeffrey's mother Joyce gave some interviews but predominantly shied away from the public eye, utterly ashamed of what her son had done. I wake up every morning, and for a split second, I don't know I'm Jeffrey Dahmer's mother, and then it all floods in. In prison, Jeffrey's reputation preceded him, and it was only a matter of time until inmates dished out their own form of prison justice. Dahmer himself knew his time would eventually come, telling his mother on a phone call from prison, "It doesn't matter, Mom. I don't care if something happens to me." On November 28, 1994, Jeffrey Dahmer was found brutally beaten by another inmate, convicted murderer Christopher Scarver. While he was on assigned work detail cleaning a staff locker room, he was viciously beaten in the head and face with a 20-inch metal bar. He was then taken to the prison infirmary, where he later succumbed to his injuries. Many wonder how the Milwaukee cannibal could have gotten away with his vile actions for so long, particularly because he followed a distinct pattern and been caught for other offenses multiple times in his life. Dahmer's apartment stank up the entire complex. It reeked like death, and neighbors even complained to management, but nothing was ever done. Jeffrey explained away the smell as spoiled meat due to his refrigerator breaking. He was one of the only white men living in a poor, predominantly black neighborhood. Most of his victims were black and homosexual, two extremely marginalized groups at the time, and some claim that the police ignored calls bringing his actions to their attention for this very reason, similar to the night that Conrad Synthesomfa was left in Dahmer's care. That incident would lead to the suspension of three officers who left the zombified boy at apartment 213 and told concerned residents to mind their own damn business. Even after the last of the bodies had been removed from the Oxford apartments, both the smell and the memory of death would forever linger throughout its halls. Demolition of the 49-unit building began in November of 1992 due to public outcry. It was said to be a symbol of anger, pain, violence, and death felt duly by both blacks and homosexuals. After the building was razed, a park was constructed on the former site of the Oxford apartments. Adorned with grass and flowers, it's a site often filled with the laughter of children as they play. But sometimes, in the distance, if you listen closely enough, it's said you can still hear the sound of knife on skin, hammer on bone, and acid dissolving flesh, as the echoes of the screams from within apartment 213 reverberate off of its non-existent walls and out into oblivion.
It was a way of making me feel that they were a part of me.
If a person doesn't think that there is a God to be accountable to, then what's the point of trying to modify your behavior to keep it within acceptable ranges. That's when I
part of me
started wanting to sort of create my own little world where I could be the one who had the complete control, where I didn't have to bow to anyone else's demands.
Part of me. Then I tried to keep the person alive by inducing a zombie-like state.
Thanks to you for sending that creation science material.
They were a part of me.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of True Crime Horror Story. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Suggested movies similar to today's case: Dahmer, a 2002 true crime horror movie directed by David Jacobson, and My Friend Dahmer, a 2017 biographical drama based on the graphic novel by Durf Backdurf and directed by Mark Myers. Suggested reading: Dahmer's Confession, The Milwaukee Cannibal's Arrest Statements by friend of the show John Borowski. And suggested listening: Dahmer, a 2000 murder metal concept album by Macabre that is featured with their permission in this episode. If you like what you hear here on True Crime Horror Story, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You can also think about joining our Patreon at www.patreon.com/truecrimehs, and then stay tuned after this show on Patreon for the True Crime Horror Story After Show with Dom and JD, as well as early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content available only on Patreon. This episode features music by Macabre, Mechanical Ghost, The Quiet Type, and Frankensquatch, as well as artwork by Frankensquatch and Nuclear Heat Graphics. Sources for this episode's case are available in the credit section of our website. Special thank you to John Borowski, Mandy aka Frankensquatch, and Macabre's manager Rodney Pollock for the use of their music in the episode. Has violent crime impacted you or someone close to you? Send us your story at truecrimehorrorstory@gmail.com. True Crime Horror Story. Sometimes truth is more brutal than fiction.